Wine this night also, and you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. Well, they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And yet, this is kinfolk to Abraham. This is Abraham's nephew, and here these sons born are born of his nephew of the same family, same ancestry, same background. The firstborn bare a son called his name Moab, the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. So the Moabites weren't of a different racial stock. The younger, she also bare a son called his name Ben-Ammi, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. Now we'll come a little bit later to another statement that's made about the Moabites not coming into the congregation of Israel for 10 generations. But if you remember the reason given back there, it didn't have to do with racial stock, but it had to do with the way they treated the Jews when they came through that land. Back to the book of Ruth again. The name of the man was Elimelech. His name means, "My God, a king." So his name doesn't suggest that he was abandoning God or forsaking God, deserting God. His name means, "My God, a king." Well, the name of his wife, either Pleasant or My Pleasantness. The name of his two sons, Malan, which meant sickliness, and Chilion, that meant consumption. Now, how would they name their kids something like that? Ephrathite. That's another name you find for the ancient name of Bethlehem. They came into the country of Moab and continued. So when they came in, it didn't look like they'd have to stay so long. They went in to sojourn. But this famine dragged on and on year after year after year, so they had to continue. Well, this is kind of a unique thing in the Jewish terminology, because they interpret the cause of the book of Ruth . Read a little bit here about their comment. It's kind of indirectly, we're taught the intense love of the Israelites for Canaan. We cannot fail to see how devoted were the bulk of the ordinary people to their beloved land. Are we not clearly to infer that in spite of the famine, only one family left the country? And that so grievous was this sin in the eyes of God that punishment overtook the head of the family almost instantaneously. Declared the rabbis, "It's not permitted to emigrate from the land of Israel, even to escape the pangs of famine, unless the price of food rises inordinately. Even this is forbidden, according to one Talmudic authority, because he who does not dwell in the land of Israel is as if he worships idols." Yet Elimelech went. From worldly consideration, he forsook the land of his fathers. And what did he choose in its place? The land of Moab. The relationship between the Hebrews and Moabites was often friendly, sometimes the reverse. Yet it's no wonder tradition looked askance at Elimelech's going. The people of Moab were, of course, nearly related to the people of Israel. They were the descendants of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. They had, however, a very different history. The pure faith that had grown up in the tents of the Hebrew patriarchs and blossomed into splendor in the days of Moses had among the Moabites withered and died. The Moabites had been a thorn in the flesh of Israel when they came out of Egypt and had even led them away into the practice of wickedness, so that Moabites were forbidden to come into the assembly of the Lord, Deuteronomy 23. Here you begin to get this Jewish teaching. that actually later began to be interpreted that God didn't accept tithes from other lands because they weren't holy. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, jump right in the middle of the story like a good Protestant would. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Eternal. Even to their tenth generation, they shall not enter into the congregation of the Eternal. Forever. Now that shows you the word forever. It doesn't mean endless. There's another Hebrew or Greek word that means endless. But as far as your lifespan, if you go 10 generations, that's forever. And yet, God Himself gives the story here of how Ruth, the Moabitess, entered into the congregation of Israel. The Bible doesn't contradict itself. So, what was the lesson being taught here? Well, read on, he'll tell you. Because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt. And because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, of Peter, of Mesopotamia, to curse you. Nevertheless, the Eternal your God would not hearken to Balaam. But the Eternal your God turned the curse into a blessing, and because the Eternal your God loved you. You will not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. You shall not abhor an Edomite, because he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were a stranger in his land. The children that are begotten of them shall enter into the congregation of the Eternal in their third generation. One false assumption and false idea people have about the people of Judah is that only native-born Jews were allowed to practice their religion. And, you know, everybody else was outside the wall, outside the court, cut off without any hope. Now, keep your finger there and we'll be back there. But notice Exodus 20. If you want to follow this study a little further, you can look up this word and trace it a little further. Exodus 20, verse 8, remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy. 6 days you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. You will not do any work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger. That is, within your gates. Now, notice even the original Ten Commandment Sabbath law, as codified here, given to the nation, the Sabbath day applied as well to the stranger. That's within your gate. Now, you might remember a little earlier, back here in Exodus 12 or 13. Exodus 12, verse 48. And when a stranger shall sojourn with you, and will keep the Passover to the Eternal. I mean, did they allow proselytes? Did they allow converts? Did they allow Gentile, foreigners, even to practice the religion of the Jews? And, well, notice what he says. When a stranger shall sojourn with you, and will keep the Passover to the Eternal, let all his males be circumcised, then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land. For no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. Now, of course, most Protestants don't want you to know that because they want you to think this whole religion was restricted and limited only to Jews. And then later on, when God opened the door to the Gentiles, why, that's the first time anybody ever had a chance. And back before that, it was the law was for the nation of Israel only. Well, and proselytes or converts or strangers. Now, back in Deuteronomy 23, some suggest one of the purposes of the book of Ruth is to show you that the day was coming when, through this descendant of this same Ruth, the door would be open for everybody to worship God and come into God's way of religion, which we know Ruth did. Deuteronomy 23 also included others that were excluded from the congregation. He that is self-mutilated or injured in the private parts shall not enter into the congregation of the eternal. The bastard shall not enter into the congregation of the eternal. So it was to teach people an abhorrence of certain extreme errors or wicked ways or wrongs. The number 10 is the number of judgment. So here we find others that weren't to enter into the congregation to the 10th generation. And then in that same lumping, it talks about the Ammonite and the Moabite, but it gives you the reason. Doesn't say because they're of a different race. They're not a different race. They're children of Lot. And not just children of Lot by some other woman, but by his own daughters even. So the reason the Ammonite and Moabite weren't to enter the congregation to the 10th generation was because they didn't meet you with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt. And yet we read you're not to hate the Egyptian. You're not to hate the Amorite because they hired against you, Balaam. So he gives the two reasons specifically. Nevertheless, the Eternal, your God, wouldn't hearken to Balaam. But God turned what would have been a curse into a blessing. But he said, now, don't join up and seek their peace or their prosperity. But that was the limit of their excluding this people. You'll not abhor an Edomite, he's your brother. You'll not abhor an Egyptian. Now, when you come to the book of Ruth, then, and we know ultimately that she joined the worship and religion of God and practiced God's religion. He gives the names here that we've mentioned the meaning of. They came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Now, is that because God was angry with them and smote them because they deserted the Holy Land and they shouldn't have been dwelling outside of that holy, sacred land? And, well, the reason they left the land is because it was under a curse of a famine. But, you know, that's the way the Jews would have you believe, that if you are born in Palestine, you're really the upper crust, and if you're born in Jerusalem, that's the highest you can be. But if you're a foreign-born and migrate back, well, you know, that's better than dwelling in the lands of the heathen. But there's no curse here. It doesn't say Elimelech was killed, that God took his life for error, and yet that's what the tradition is. Verse 4, they took them wives. That you might remember that phrase. They took them wives. Here's what Kipto says, a kind of phrase which usually occurs in a bad sense, as done without the concurrence of their parents, are not left so entirely to them as custom requires. Now you might remember back earlier in Genesis, you know. Turn back there just a second. Chapter 6, Genesis 6. Came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth. That doesn't suggest women weren't multiplying either, you know. It's just suggesting mankind was multiplying. They were growing in numbers, both man and woman. When mankind began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, of course, that doesn't suggest sons weren't born to them. But, you know, people try to read into things what isn't there. Mankind began to multiply. And the emphasis is on the daughters that were being born to a vastly populating group of people. Well, the sons of God, the people who were called by God's name, that worshiped God, that supposedly went God's way, They began to ignore what God said, and they began to go by sight. They saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Now, notice the terminology there. That isn't the way Isaac got his wife. That isn't the way Jacob got his wife. No, they didn't have God's hand in their wives in this chapter, the way Isaac and Jacob and Abraham all did. They didn't pay any attention to God's ways. They took. Now, that's repeated quite often in Genesis. Chapter 38, verse 2. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Genesis 34 and verse 2. When Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. Over and over again, Genesis 4 verse 1. Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bare Cain and said, I've gotten. She didn't say, God gave me. She said, I've gotten. So over and over, you can see the use of the terminology here. So, a lot of people would stop on verse 4. Now, in the Wheaton commentary mentions, the law condemned intermarriages with the Canaanitish tribes, but inasmuch as Israel and Moab were descended from kindred ancestors, Abraham and Lot, not with the daughters of the Moabites, it commanded, however, that Moabite, even at the tenth generation, should enter the congregation of the Lord. Well, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, the law was so construed as to prohibit all intermarriage with foreigners, that it was a distinguishing feature of the age of the judges. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. The law wasn't enforced. Men forgot the commandments of the Lord, indulged in such looseness as even to intermarry with the idolatrous Canaanites. Now, of course, the condemnation there was intermarriage with someone who had another god. Now, that isn't right. So, keep your bearing straight on that when you're going through Ruth. They were wrong to take them wives. Well, now, did God just smite them with death and make them die in the land because they took the Moabite wives? Now, you don't get that out of the rest of the story of Ruth when you think about the kind of woman she was and how God honored her by letting her be the mother of the line of David. So there's no doubt there was a mistake made in verse 4. They took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. Her name means friendship or a friend. They dwell there about 10 years. There again, 10 is the number of judgment. Malan and Chilion died, both of them. Now, why would you read into this that God smote them because of the intermarriage? That God smote the dad because he left the Holy Land and went into a foreign country and actually stayed there? Well, of course, if he was there during the days of that 7-year famine, then they had to stay more than 7 years. And the word that suggested when they went down, they sojourned there. And then the way it's worded later suggests that you didn't say, well, I think I'll go down into the land of Moab. There's going to be a famine 7 years. You don't know that. You go down there planning to come back, but the famine isn't over, isn't over, isn't over, so you keep staying and staying and staying. And finally, they return. Well, the way the Jews would read this in Sansino's commentary, he says, well, you know, Ruth apparently was a better Christian woman than her husband was a Christian man, so she realized her sin in forsaking the Holy Land, and so as soon as her husband and sons were dead, she said, I'm getting out of here. God cursed me for living down here. I'm going back to the Holy Land. Well, I don't know why they read that into the Bible. Maybe They need to get the population back in Judea. Maybe they need to get more Jews in Judah than there are in New York City. Well, they hadn't succeeded yet, but anyway, going on, they dwell there about 10 years. Then both of these sons died. The woman was left with her two sons. Now, can you imagine that? Her name means pleasantness. And boy, she is driven out of the homeland by a famine. Her husband dies in a foreign land. Her two sons die in a foreign land. They both marry daughters of this foreign land. And now she's going to go back to Palestine. Leave her buried husband. Leave her two buried sons. She's probably thinking, the famine's over. It says that's why she went back. You read on. It doesn't say, well, this land's been a nightmare to me, and it's taken my husband and my two sons, and I'm going to get out of here. Humanly, you'd say, well, I'm 3/4 of me is buried here already anyway. I'll just go ahead and stay here, and they bury me here. But that isn't what it says. Anyway, notice going on. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. Now notice the reason. Because she'd heard in the country of Moab how that the Eternal had visited his people in giving them bread. So apparently the whole land that they fled from had been hit with this famine. And now a word got back that God had intervened and blessed them with the blessing instead of the trouble. And now he visited his people and giving them bread. So that suggests the whole country was under a curse or in a plague, and only when a judge came along that agreed to get back to God, and they all agreed, then God would restore the blessing of the land, and might well have been in the time of Gideon. You know, it says in the days of Gideon they had, 40 years of prosperity and peace after the time of judgment. How long would it take you to get word that the famine had ended? How long after a 7-year famine is over are you sure it's fully over? You know, if you've had it for 7 years, the first year it might say, well, it looks like it's over. But, you know, let's wait a little bit longer. And maybe after another year you say, well, you know, maybe it really is permanently over. Maybe we ought to go on back. So maybe they would wait till a 10th year. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return into the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. The Eternal deal kindly with you, as you've dealt with the dead and with me. So apparently they've been good wives. Apparently they've been she was happy with them and pleased with them, and they dwelt kindly with their husbands while they were alive. And the Eternal grant you that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said to her, surely we'll return with you and to your people. Now, why would anybody ever do that unless they'd already been greatly impressed by their religion, their morals, their background, the stories about their old country and the way they lived and what they did? Why would two daughters-in-law pick up stakes, leave dead husbands, leave parents, leave their whole heredity and environment and background? They had no children to take with them. This lady had no more sons they could have any interest in back in Israel. It must have been the religion that caused them to really be moved here. Naomi said, turn again, my daughter. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husband? Now, does that mean by law that they would be required to bear children to their brothers' wives when their brothers had died? Or did this mean that they'd hope that maybe she had some other sons, or maybe she'd get married again and have some more sons? Turn again, my daughters. Go your way. I'm too old to have an husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have an husband also tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait and hope for them till they were grown? Would you save for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieves me much for your sake that the hand of the Eternal has gone out against me. Now, she just understood that God hadn't blessed her and God hadn't been with her, and so she was, her happiness was turned into sorrow and grief. And you know, one of the great lessons in the book of Ruth is you can have a name like My Pleasantness or Pleasantness, and yet if you lose your husband, and if you lose your two sons, and you look like you're going to lose your two daughters-in-law, and you come back to your land, you're back to your home country, and you've already had to sell your land because of famine, that sounds like you're just about through. And yet the line of David came from a woman that went through that. Well, look how thin the thread was between her and extinction. And yet look at the line of David, the greatest line in all of man's history. And yet it came from, look at this impossibility. Out of famine, fleeing to a land and losing your husband and sons and daughters-in-law. And yet your pleasantness turned into gall and bitterness. Well, they lifted up their voice. They wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clave unto her. She said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and unto her God. Return you after your sister-in-law." So apparently this one daughter-in-law just finally was more than she could bear. Apparently she went with her part of the way and just couldn't leave home or couldn't stand the thought of abandoning everything in the background to go. Now, is God testing a woman here to cause the woman to be the mother of the line of David? Well, the other daughter-in-law went back to her God and to her people. Now, the famous words, verse 16, that are sung in a lot of marriages, didn't really apply to a marriage, applied to a daughter-in-law with a mother-in-law. Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you, or to return from following after you. For where you go, I'll go, and where you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." Well, can that be? What about that law in Deuteronomy we read? They're not to be allowed in the congregation for 10 generations or forever. And yet she said, "Your God will be my God, your people will be my people. Where you lodge, I'll lodge." It's kind of interesting. In the Chaldean paraphrase on this, "And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave and return from following after you, for I desire to become a proselyte. Said Naomi, we're commanded to observe the Sabbath and good days in not traveling more than 2,000 cubits. Said Ruth, to every place where you go, I'll go. Said Naomi, we're commanded not to lodge with a Gentile. Said Ruth, wheresoever you lodge, I'll lodge. Said Naomi, we're commanded to keep 613 precepts. Sounds a little bit like a Jewish propaganda. Said Ruth, what your people keep, I'll keep, as if they were my people from of old until now. Said Naomi, we're commanded not to worship with a strange worship. Said Ruth, your God shall himself be my God. Said Naomi, we have four kinds of capital punishment for criminals: stoning, burning, beheading, and hanging. Said Ruth, and whatever way you die, I'll die. You know, this doesn't make sense. Were they planning on being criminals? Why did they have to worry about the four ways of being capital punishment? Said Naomi, we have a house of burial. Said Ruth, and there I'll be buried. Well, it's a Chaldean paraphrase. It's enough to turn you off on all paraphrases. makes you realize some of the fraud that's perpetrated in the name of religion and how things are added to the Bible. Well, back to Ruth chapter 1 again. Where you die, and there I'll be buried. The eternal do so to me and more also, if aught but death part you and me. Now, why would she say anything like that if she weren't already agreed to wrap herself up in this religion? How'd she know anything about the eternal? You know, oddly enough, this is the first time anybody took on themselves an oath like this by calling down on themselves a stroke of divine judgment in case they didn't keep their word. And we get it from Ruth. And yet others later made the same kind of statement. They bound themselves to an oath. Well, there's a lot more in that passage than meets the eye, because she certainly shows very plainly that Naomi had done a good job in teaching her about their religion and their practices and their country and their home life. And otherwise, why would she abandon everything that she'd ever known to go to a strange land just to be with one stepmother? It always seemed to be a paradox about daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law. Why can't they be like they are in the Book of Ruth? It's always Proverbs, you know. We say mixed emotion, seeing your mother-in-law go off the cliff in your new Cadillac. Well, you know, why do we have jokes about mother-in-laws and daughters-in-law? They're famous for having troubles with one another, and yet look at this in the Book of Ruth. Well, she was committed to death. She was committed to God. She was committed to leaving her area and being permanent there. Well, verse 8:19, so they too went until they came to Bethlehem. It came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was astir about them, and they said, is this Naomi? Now, it wasn't as if they didn't recognize her. They're saying, has that once cheerful, pleasant wife, that honored Elimelech, come to this day of sorrow? Is this really a Naomi? When you left here, you had a husband and two sons, and you just radiated what your name depicted, pleasant. And now, can this really be you? So now she says, don't call me Naomi, pleasant. Call me Mara. Waters of Mara, bitterness. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Now, you can't take that to mean God cursed her because she left Palestine and took up dwelling in a heathen country like Moab. And of course, like Sonsino says, I can't believe he could say that we can't fail to see how devoted were the bulk of the ordinary people to their beloved land. And then he says, are we not clearly to infer that in spite of the famine, only one family left the country? I would never make an assumption like that. How would you ever assume only Ruth and, only Naomi and Elimelech and her two sons, they're the only ones left the country? Everybody else stayed. Nobody else left. That sounds an odd assumption. But he says that's what we're to clearly infer, that in spite of that family, only one family left that holy land. Why? And so the rabbis have declared it not allowed, not permitted to immigrate. Now, that isn't what you read here. God hadn't protected her. God hadn't allowed her to come back with her husband and son. So, naturally, she felt her life was embittered. Instead of being preserved from famine in another country, she loses the husband and both sons. I went out full. The Eternal has brought me home again empty. Why then call you me Naomi, seeing the Eternal has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. So apparently, contrasting the coming at a harvest time in April after having left at a famine time with nothing. And now the big harvest is beginning. Well, I doubt if any of us who've ever read the book of Ruth ever got the idea that she lost the husband and both sons for forsaking the glorious Holy Land. Anybody here ever get that out of it? I can't figure out how Jews ever got that out of it. You know, it was kind of odd to me when one of our ex-ministers began to talk about you can't tithe in foreign lands, you know. God doesn't accept your tithe if you're in Babylon, if you're in Turkey, or if you're in Egypt. God doesn't accept the tithe. You don't have to tithe in those countries. And that God doesn't expect you to tithe if you're a fisherman, you know. Only if you have corn, wine, and oil. You know, the rest of people made it, they got lucky, you know. They were in lumbering or in fishing or in something else. But boy, if you're one of those unlucky guys that got into those businesses with corn, wine, and oil, too bad, buddy, you just got a tithe. After all, doesn't it say in the scriptures the tithe of the corn and the wine and the oil? Yeah, it does a lot of times. But you know, they don't realize in many cases God uses that number three as a summary. Just like he did about the summary of the different kinds of creatures. You know, you might assume God never created the three kinds of creatures. Because he only lists those three kinds in summary, you know. The beast and the fowl and the creeping thing. So that means there aren't anything else. Well, you go visit the zoo, there sure are. But you see, if you don't want to tithe, then you'll find some excuse to not tithe. So if you happen to be in a foreign land, you say, well, I'd be glad to tithe if I were in the Holy Land. Well, that's God's land. If I were there, God would be blessing that land, but you don't expect God to bless Germany. We Jews in Germany, you know, among all these heathen, you know, God can't bless this country, so we don't have to tithe. That is really a weird reason. I haven't heard any such thing until some of our scholarly, intellectual, brainy ministers informed us on all that. Well, chapter 2. Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth. Now, according to the Jewish tradition, he was a nephew of Elimelech. Anyway, whatever kin it was, you can't nail it down language-wise. But Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz, which means strong, agile. In a sense, it's the counterpart of the name virtuous. One's female and the other was masculine, but they both mean the same thing as far as vigor and strength and agile. Well, Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn after him. Now here again, the word corn doesn't mean corn on the cob like we think of. The word corn is the overall general word that means any grain. It includes wheat, oats, barley. In Scotland, the word's used strictly for oats. In America, mainly it means Indian corn or maize. But back in the Bible time, it meant any of these various kinds of grain. So here Ruth shows the virtuous trait of hard work. She says to Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean grain after him in whose sight I'll find grace. In other words, you had to be permitted by the owner or the manager of the field to be allowed to glean in his field. Now, they had to allow gleaners in any field. But, you know, they didn't have to let a swarm of ants get out there and just trample down the ground and devour everything. So that was overseen. So that shows this here. She had to find someone that she would find favor in their sight and find grace. And then she'd be allowed among the gleaners, and they followed right after the people cutting in the harvest. She said to her, go, my daughter. Well, she treated her like her own daughter. Well, she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. You might notice several of these laws about gleaning. Leviticus 13. Leviticus 19. Here we go. Leviticus 19, verse 9. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleaning of your harvest. In other words, you go across the crop once, and then what is left behind or falls, let poor people have it. And also don't cut all the way into the corners. So don't wholly reap the corners of your field, neither gather the gleanings of your harvest. You'll not glean your vineyard, take every grape, neither shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You'll leave them for the poor and strangers. Notice again, strangers. Stranger had a lot more to do with the religion and the laws of Israel than you've ever been told. Because the Protestants want you to think all those laws were strictly for Israel. And then later on, when God forsook Israel, then all those laws were to be done away with because they only were exclusively for Israel in the first place. Well, that isn't true. That was made for man, wasn't made for Israel. These were the holy days. Well, several other places, Deuteronomy 24. These big harvest machines they have in our day, it would be easy to leave gleanings because those machines drop a great deal and miss a lot of it. Deuteronomy 24, verse 19. When you cut down your harvest in your field and have forgot a sheaf in the field, you will not go again to fetch it. It'll be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. Now notice, if a man were kind and thought of the people like this, and notice, strangers even listed first, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So if you follow that law of caring about the fatherless and the widow, the stranger, then God will bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you'll not go over the boughs again. It'll be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And when you gather the grapes to your vineyard, you'll not glean it afterward. It'll be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. You remember, you were a bondman in the land of Egypt. But if you make Egyptians in your land bondsmen, you go ahead and allow them to be strangers and let them benefit from this law of gleaning. So I command you to do this thing. Okay, coming on back to Ruth again then. And verse 3. And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Well, it happened to her, or she just happened to light on a part of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, of course, it shows us they didn't have fences on properties back then. And how would you know whose property you're on? Well, people weren't that hard-nosed about it. In fact, if you were walking on a journey and you got hungry, you'd just go right through the guy's vineyard or olive yard or field and pluck off and eat as you went through. You couldn't take a bushel basket with you and fill it up. So they couldn't tell one field from another. So she went and came and gleaned in the field. God just caused it to happen that she ended up in Boaz's field. He was of the kindred of Elimelech. Behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Eternal be with you." They answered him, "The Eternal bless you." Now imagine that kind of kindness among the people. Now remember, some of these people were strangers. Some of these people were foreigners. You think the Moabites would have treated these Israelites like they did in Moab if the Israelites had been that hard on foreigners when they were in Israel? We just read who all was included in this gleaning. Now look what Boaz said to these strangers, fatherless and widows. "The Eternal be with you." They answered him, "The Eternal bless you." In other words, they knew what God's law said back there we just read. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Hear you not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maiden." Otherwise, you might cross over in somebody else's field. You wouldn't know that it was the same field. There's no fence there, no territories. So you better stay close behind these other
ladies that are helping my workers. Now, my maidens is a term that probably women servants that Boaz was using out in the field, performing some lighter jobs of making bands and arranging the farm and size of the sheaves. So apparently they had some of the women even hired and paid and were working there. And so he's just saying, stay close with them so you don't wander off in somebody else's field. They might not treat you as kindly, or they may not, they may discriminate against you because you're a Moabite, but there's no suggestion she was discriminated against at all. Let your eyes be on the field that they do reap. You go after them. Haven't I charged the young men that they shall not touch you? Now, there's a lot said in that. Because apparently the job of reaping, reapers weren't famous for being real successful people, and they'd have a tendency to do things that a man of culture or education or accomplishment wouldn't do. So Boaz recognized the need to command or charge these young men to not get any interest in her. Just leave her alone. Don't touch her. Now, when you're athirst, you go to the vessels and drink of that which the young men have drawn. And normally that wasn't allowed, reapers. They had to go after their own water. And wells were quite a ways from fields, if you know how rare wells were over in Palestine. But now he's showing special kindness to her, that she can just go right up there and drink right out of the vessels that the young men have drawn. Well, because of that, she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said to him, why have I found grace in your eyes? You're seeing illustrated here a lot of those things we went over in the book of Proverbs. Because her outstanding traits are hard work, respect for a mother-in-law, respect for the elderly, devotedness to this new religion. So Boaz hadn't been attracted by her beauty, yet she's young enough that he knows these reapers would be casting glances her way, so he commands them not to touch her. So she can't figure out why she's found grace in his eyes, that he should take knowledge of me, seeing I'm a stranger. She's a foreigner, a stranger. She's not of a different race, but just of a different country. Boaz answered and said to her, it's fully been showed me all that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. So that's the first thing that impressed him about her. The kindness, the hard work, the concern for the elderly. Of course, he's an older man too. He probably thinks his wife is older. The lady would look after her mother-in-law that much. How much would she look after her husband? So he's being impressed by her, and he said, now it's been fully shown me all that you've done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you've left your father and your mother, you left the land of your nativity, you're come to a people that you don't know from the time till you got here. The eternal recompense your work, and a full reward be given you of the eternal, the God of Israel, under whose wings you're come to trust. So he showed great kindness there, and he recognized that she understood this God of this nation, and that she trusted him to take care of her instead of her own family and relatives and her own people and her own country. So how much more would someone have to prove what they'd be willing to give up to follow God and God's way? She gave up as much as any of us ever had to give up. God said, if you forsake father and mother or sister or brother in this life, why, he'll give it back to you. He's doing that right here. Well, then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for that you have comforted me and for that you've spoken kindly. You've spoken to the heart of your handmaid. Though I be not like unto one of your handmaids. In other words, I'm not employed by you. I don't have to be allowed to drink the water out of the vessel. I don't have to be allowed to follow right immediately behind the very harvesters to get the choice or to get first picks on the gleaning. One man comments about the "you've comforted me." This is Cassell's writing again. To the humble mind of Ruth, the words of Boaz were the first sunbeam that broke through the grief and tears of many weeks. Hitherto, she tasted only parting sorrow. Now, for the first time, she's addressed about the God of Israel and His grace, the full import of His words. Her humble heart does not presume to appropriate, but the kindliness of the speaker's voice is for her like the sound of a bubbling spring in the desert to the thirsty. The word of love comes on a loving heart like hers, long afflicted by sorrow, like morning dews on a thirsty field. So here she says, you know, for the first time, someone has really spoken to her heart and spoken to her greatly about God and asking God to recompense her and give her a full reward, and that you're under His wing. Now, of course, God's protection was always likened to the eagle protecting its young with the wings. Many places, Psalm 91 verse 4 talks about that. Psalm 57 verse 1 talks about that. First place, way back in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 11. In many places, God looking after you is likened to the eagle, the way it takes care of its young and protects them under the wing. Going on, showing the increasing favor more and more, verse 13, "You've comforted me, you've spoken to my heart." Boaz said to her, "At mealtime, come you here and eat of the bread and dip your morsel in the vinegar." So now, instead of having to look after her own meal while she's a gleaner, he invites her to come in, and they had tents that they used for the heat of the day, and then this light lunch they had in the middle of the day, he invited her to come in. "Eat of the bread, dip your morsel in the vinegar." Well, she sat beside the reapers. First, he reached her parched corn, and she did eat, and was suffice and left. When she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and don't shame her in any way. Don't shout at her, or charge her, or challenge her, or if she's gleaning even among the sheaves." So now he's giving her even more license and liberty nobody else has given. Then he actually says, "Let fall also some of the handfuls of spoil for her." Her purpose should be, leave them, that she may glean them, and don't shame her. So she gleaned in the field until even. So even after dark, when the sun begins to go down, then they beat out what they've gleaned through the day. And this time she had about 9/10 of a bushel of barley. Quite a bit just for gleaning. Well, she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she gleaned. It expresses more than that in the Hebrew. She didn't just see it. She was kind of surprised and shocked by what all she gleaned. She brought forth, gave to her that she had reserved or left, that she was, after she was sufficed. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today? Where wrought you? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of you." And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she'd wrought, said, "The man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz." Well, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be the he of the eternal, who hadn't left off his kindness to the living." So the first gleam of hope finally comes to Naomi. They finally found this long-lost near kinsman that she'd been aware of, she knew about, but now, by chance, she just happened to work in that field, and God caused him to give her favor and notice Ruth. So she really sings out with joy, "Hallelujah, you know, blessed be the eternal He's not left off his kindness to the living and the dead. Well, Naomi said to her, the man is near kin to us, one of our next kin, or one that has the right to redeem. Well, then Ruth the Moabite said, he said to me also, you'll keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest. In other words, you get right up the front of the gleaners and stay right behind the harvesters. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it's good, my daughter, that you go out with his maiden, that they meet you not in any other field. In other words, don't stay right with them. Don't get wandering off in some other field. You know, God has worked things out, so we've got to stick right in there, stick close by those maidens and those reapers. So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean into the end of barley harvest, and then all the way through wheat harvest, and continued dwelling with her mother-in-law. Well, a good bit of time is running on through there. Now, chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? In other words, you've had to work hard long enough, and after all, we have this near kinsman. It's his obligation to redeem the widow of one of his dead near kinsmen, so let me do something about this. Let me intervene and seek rest so you don't have to keep on gleaning in the field. Now, if not Boaz of our kindred, with the right of redemption, with whose maidens you were, behold, he went as barley tonight and threshing for her. For once the harvest is gathered up through the day, then in the evening when the wind blows more, then they do this working in the threshing floor. I might read just a comment or two here about the way they do in the threshing floor. The wind of grain was left overnight lying in a heap. This exposed the threshing floors to the danger of being robbed. An example of that is 1 Samuel 23 and verse 1. So someone had to stay out with the heap of winnowed grain that you had left there. One traveler wrote a book, Thompson says, we have on various occasions seen the summer threshing floors in the open country and the owner sleeping at them to prevent stealing. Another traveler through the Middle East says, natives of the East care little for sleeping accommodation, but rest where weariness overcomes them, lying on the ground. They are, however, careful to cover the feet, and to do this, they have a sheet of coarse cloth that they tuck under the feet, drawing it up over the body, suffer it to cover the face and head. An Oriental seldom changes his position. We're told Boaz did so because he was afraid. The covering of the feet in ordinary cases is consequently not disturbed. I frequently observe when riding out in a native city before dawn figures with their feet so covered, lying like monumental effigies in the pathway and in the open verandas of the houses. The threshing floor, this is a level plot of ground of a circular shape, generally about 50 feet in diameter, beaten down to a hard, smooth surface. On this, the sheaves of grain were thrown. The threshing was usually performed by driving cattle over them, the scriptural mode of treading out the corn. Coming back to the account for this, verse 3. Wash therefore yourself, therefore, and anoint you. Put your raiment upon you. Now, you know, if we were in the modern world, it should say, wash yourself, therefore, and put on your makeup and anoint yourself. No, it never does say that. When any woman of God was ever getting ready for courtship or romance or marriage, you don't ever find anything like that. You can talk about the three places where it seems to say that somebody painted their face or their eyes, but think about the 88 places that it shows how women of God got ready and never ever mentions it in a positive way. Aren't people always want to zero in on the negative way. I noticed the man that wrote the original articles against Mr. Armstrong's understanding and teaching of the Bible on makeup, one of our intellectual, brainy ministers that doesn't even have as much religion as a Baptist now, proceeded to do some great research, and he jumps on three scriptures. He doesn't bother all these 88 others that talk about the other positive approach. He just attacks those three. And very conveniently, you know, he'll use whichever commentary agrees with what he wants them to say. And the odd thing is, he'll use one commentary a couple of places, and he doesn't use it in the other one. I got a little curious, so I got it out, checked it out, and I can see why he didn't use it in the other one. They totally disagreed with what he wanted to say. Well, think how many opposite examples you find like this. What's Naomi telling Ruth? Well, you ought to be clean and smell good and prepare yourself for gaining the favor of a prospective redeemer, a kinsman, near kinsman. So, you know, put on your face and get ready. You know, wash yourself, therefore, and anoint you, and put your raiment upon you, and get you down to the floor. But make not yourself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lieth down, that you'll mark the place where he'll lie. You'll go in and uncover his feet and lay you down, and he'll tell you what you shall do. Now, you'll see a little later that the feet, and when someone has reached an agreement, they take off the shoe. What in the world has that got to do with an agreement? You know, we just shake hands. Back there, somebody gave somebody a shoe? That's weird. Well, what does the shoe symbolize? What does it mean to be under somebody's feet? What does it mean to be brought up at the feet of the male? What does it mean all the way through the Bible when it talks about at the feet or the feet of somebody? Well, there was a reason. You know, there's one weirdo that wrote a book against the Bible and says, boy, he wouldn't let his kids read the Bible. It's a horror book. It's got all these unbalanced sex stories in it, even. And it talks about this one. You know, how dare Ruth go in there and uncover herself at the bottom of his feet, you know. Well, there's no immorality in this story at all. You can't even read into that anything. First place, if you're going in to seduce some guy to get him to marry you, you're not going to fly down to his stinking feet, you know. That'd be the last thing you'd do. He wouldn't uncover his feet and lie there all night, especially after he's already finished eating and drinking. And he's sound asleep, you know. He's sleeping like a log. And, well, let's read the story and find out what happened anyway. Don't make yourself known to the man until he's done eating and drinking. Then when he lieth down, then you mark the place where he'll lie. Because there wasn't just one person there. There are other people there. How many people do you think would be there to keep somebody from robbing your new harvest you just harvested? You got servants to do all the harvesting, but when it comes to protecting the whole day's harvest of all these servants, the boss sticks his neck out to get killed there to protect the grain? Well, he's there with everybody else. He wasn't there by himself. So she said, you've got to mark the place where he's going to lie down. You don't want to get the surprise yourself and wake up at the feet of Bill over there instead of Boaz. You go in and uncover his feet. Lay you down, he'll tell you what you shall do. Just as open as being under somebody's feet, being willing to be taught, to be, you know, the symbolism. She said to her, all that you say to me, I'll do. She's very respectful and very obedient. Well, she went down to the floor. She's abiding by the law of Israel. She's not just hearkening to her mother-in-law's talk, you know. It's respect for God's law. She respects Naomi's knowledge of what God's law says. So Naomi said, look, this is according to God's law. This is all within the law of God. So she says, all that you say, you've been in this religion all your life, you know all about it, so all that you say to me, I'll do. Well, she went down to the floor, did according to all her mother-in-law bade her, and Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. She came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. Well, came to pass, somewhere in the middle of the night, all of a sudden he had a fright because he realized his feet were uncovered, and he turned himself, or he bent forward. He raised up to see what happened. His feet weren't covered. Well, behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" She answered, "I'm Ruth, your handmaid. Spread therefore your skirt over your handmaid, because you have the right of redemption." So there again is a token of protection and shelter and provision and security. And he spread the skirt over her. He said, "Blessed be you of the Eternal, my daughter." Now, that kind of talk you don't do when you're being seduced, you know, or you're getting involved with somebody sexually. That's kind of ridiculous. Now, no such thing happened here, but leave it up to some of these goody writers. Even Whedon has to explain his way out of this as if there's some embarrassing thing for people to read, and where he says, spread your skirt over your handmaid. Same word as we read earlier about wings. Spread your wings. He didn't have any wings. It's a token or a symbol of protection and security. Take me into the protection and intimacy of the marriage relation. Some scriptures even talk about the marriage state like a mother bird covering young with wings. For example, Ezekiel 16 and verse 8, God represent himself spreading his wing over Jerusalem in the time of love, taking her to wife. Deuteronomy 22 verse 30, Deuteronomy 27 verse 20, a man that was guilty of incest was represented as one that uncovered his father's skirt because he meddles with that. In other words, he's doing something that isn't right. He's uncovering somebody's nakedness. But if you cover somebody over with your wing, it's used of... Turn and read this one, Ezekiel 16 and verse 8. And he hadn't let the Bible interpret the Bible. God says, "Now when I passed by you and looked upon you, behold, your time was the time of love. I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. Yea, I swear to you and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord Eternal, and you became mine." So she was saying, "Take me into your protection and your security and provision, and spread your skirt or your wings over me." And he says, "Blessed be you of the Eternal, my daughter. For you showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as you followed not young men, whether poor or rich." Well, now your blessedness is even beyond what it was when I first got acquainted with what you've done, leaving your own home and your own kindred and your own dead husband buried and left with this elderly mother-in-law and came back to her land. But your latter kindness is even more than that first. Now look what you've done. Instead of following after the young men, some of them were rich. You had opportunities. I've had to keep guys' orders to not touch you. And yet, instead of being interested in physique and interested in age and muscle and rich, your latter end even excels your earlier kindness. You showed more kindness now in this latter end. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I'm going to do for you all that you've asked. Because all the gate of my people does know that you're a virtuous one. Well, she was above reproach. Everybody, all people in the gates of Bethlehem knew what a virtuous woman she was. After all, who would ever do all that to go with a mother-in-law and to work that hard and to go out and glean and especially when she had a near kinsman. Now, it's true I'm your near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. But apparently, Naomi hadn't even realized that. Didn't know who was still alive and who wasn't. But now, all of a sudden, I imagine a lump came up in their throat and thought, oh, no, there's a nearer kinsman. And boy, well, he said, you tarry this night, and it'll be in the morning. If he'll perform to you the part of the kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he'll not do the part of the kinsman to you, then I'll do the part of the kinsman to you as the eternal is. Lie down till the morning. You might read back in Deuteronomy 25. Verse 5, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her next kinsman shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of an husband's brother to her, and it'll be the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother. Now, it doesn't say you have to name him the same name. It just says, you know, they named him Obed. They didn't name him Boaz. They didn't name him, not Boaz, but the first husband's name. She shall succeed in the name of his brother, which is dead, that his name be put not put out of Israel. So it's strictly for the inheritance of the land and the name. If the man like not to take his near kinsman's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up to his brother a name in Israel. He'll not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he still persists that he won't do it, say, I don't like to take her. Then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, loose his shoe from off his foot, and spit in his face, and shall answer and say, so shall it be done to that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that has his shoe loose. Now, your shoe has to do with standing on land as a token of what belongs to you. And that's why they would do that. They would say, here, you take this shoe. In other words, I'm giving up my right to stand on that land as my land. I'm giving up my right there. You stand on that land. I'm giving you that right. Come back to Ruth again. Okay, verse 14, chapter 3. She lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could discern another. In other words, they were avoiding any appearance of evil. So before you could tell who was who, she went ahead and left and got out of there. Let it not be known that the woman came into the floor. Also he said, bring the veil that you have on you and hold it. So you notice again, oddly enough, when someone approached someone about anything connected with marriage, they didn't want them to go by their appearance. They wanted them to go by their character and their heart and their inward being, so they veiled themselves, so they wouldn't go by appearance. But now he said, here, bring that veil that you have on you and hold it. And it wasn't a sheer veil like you think of today. Well, when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. So here she's carrying this barley and this veil over her shoulder that she had over her whole body when she came. Well, she came to her mother-in-law, and she said, it doesn't say, who are you, but how did it go? Or, you know, are you engaged, or what are you? You know, you come back like you went, or you come back... What character do you return? Is the espouse of Boaz, or just still a desolate widow? So that's really what she's asking there. And she told her all that the man had done to her, and she said, these 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said to me, go not empty to your mother-in-law. Then she said, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will fall. In other words, we just have to have patience and keep praying about it. ask God to work it out. And surely God didn't cause you to go on Boaz's field and cause him to have favor toward you just for you to end up married to this other kinsman we didn't even know about. So, have faith and be patient and sit still, my daughter, till you know how the matter will fall, because the man will not rest until he's finished the thing this day. So the way he talked to you, he's going to get it solved today. Well, Boaz went up to the gate, sat him down there. Behold, the near kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, and to whom he said, "Oh, such a one, hey, Bill Smith, turn aside, sit down here." So he turned aside and sat down. So the idea is that everybody went by the gate sometime during the day. So here this guy comes by, and he catches him at the time, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city. Therefore, you know, in order to ever have a synagogue, you have to have 10 men. And what's that said? Oh, I never did think it said that, but that's what everybody else was taking it to say. So you have to have 10 before you can have a synagogue. Yet Christ said, "Where 2 or 3 are gathered in His name, there He's in the midst of them." That doesn't mean you got a church when you got 2 or 3 either. Well, the word church has a variety of meanings. It can mean the church leadership. It can mean the church membership. It can mean the church government. Don't try to force the word church to mean one and exclude the other. It can mean any of them. 2 or 3 people gathered together aren't a church. Well, he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit you down here," and they sat down. Well, he said to the near kinsman, "Naomi, that's come again out of the country of Moab, sells a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech." Now, of course, apparently, as long as the widow was still alive, she could make transactions about land, but if the widow died, then that land automatically would go back to the brother or the nearest of kin. But here it's termed as if she's going to sell a parcel of land. Yet, you know, it only was sold for 49 years, and on the 50th year, it always went back to whoever name it originally was carried in. So they're going to figure out who gets this land back when the land comes back on the Jubilee year. Well, he said, I thought to disclose it to you, saying, buy it before the inhabitants, people who are here, and before the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if you'll not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. Because there's none to redeem it besides you, and I'm after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. Well, then Boaz said, what day you buy the field of the hand of Naomi, you must buy it also of Ruth the Moabite, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance. Now, of course, right away, the Jews would have you believe that, you know, one guy made a mistake marrying a Moabite. He's sure not going to be one to make a mistake. But the story of the book of Ruth isn't to make you feel somebody made a mistake marrying the woman that's going to be the mother of David. Well, anyway, look what happened. I can't redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. So either he was already married, or else he couldn't do it legally. It would foul things up because of his status at the time. Lest I mar mine own inheritance, take you my right of redemption to yourself, because I can't redeem it. Well, now he didn't say I won't, he said I can't. So the suggestion isn't he wouldn't do it because of her being a Moabite at all. Now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing or exchanging, for to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. In the sense of saying, I've walked on that land, it belonged to me, it was under my foot, it was under my authority, I owned it. Now I'm, as a symbol showing you that you walk on that land. Let it be under your feet, I'm giving it to you. This is a testimony or a token or a witness in Israel. Therefore this near kinsman said to Boaz, buy it for you. So he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said to the elders, and to all the people, you're witnesses this day that I brought all that was Elimelech and all that was Chilion's and Malan's out of the hand of Naomi. So apparently the widow that stayed back in Moab had gotten married. Otherwise, how could he buy the land also that belonged to both of those sons? So Boaz told the people that they were witnesses that he bought all that was Elimelech and all that was Chilion's and Malan's of the hand of Naomi. And moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Malan, I have acquired to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren. Now, of course, a near kinsman who was not married, who would do something like that, was regarded highly. He was shown that he really did care about a dead relative or a dead kinsman. You're witnesses this day. Well, all the people that were in the gate, the elders said, we're witnesses. The Eternal make the woman that's come into your house like Rachel and like Leah. Now, how does that coincide with other things that have been said? You know, the elders and all the people that were in the gate said, the Eternal make the woman that's come into your house like Rachel and like Leah. In a sense, she is like Rachel and Leah, the ancestor of David. They too did build the house of Israel, and they're saying that this Ruth also is going to build the house of Israel by giving birth to the David whose dynasty carried on. Do you worthily in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. Let your house be like the house of Pharaoh, and Tamar, bear the Judah, of the seed which the Eternal shall give you of this young woman. Now there's no way the elders of the city and all the people would make all that proclamation about Ruth unless she was really an example of a Christian woman. Someone who totally lived this way of God's way of life. When you think about what they said there, Rachel, your house like the house of Pharaoh, the Eternal give you of this young woman. Well, Boaz took Ruth. Now, that's a little different way that's worded. He didn't take to himself, or in this case, there he's already fulfilled his right as the near kinsman, so he takes what he's already worked out and done, and she became his wife. And he went into her, the Eternal gave her conception, she bare a son. The women said to Naomi, blessed be the Eternal, which has not left you this day without a kinsman, and let that his name be famous in Israel. That's quite a prophecy, or quite a witness ahead of time. You know, it's almost impossible to leave a woman that was in Moab who'd lost her young husband, and lost her dad, and lost her brother-in-law, and now all of a sudden look what's happening to her. The women said to Naomi, blessed be the Eternal, which hasn't left you this day without a kinsman. Let his name be famous in Israel, and he'll be to you a restorer of your life and a nourisher of your old age. Because your daughter-in-law, which loves you, which is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. That's quite a witness to the blessed life that Boaz was entering into. He was much older than she was. Yet she was interested in spiritual things and things of character in the heart, and not great physical romance and all kinds of modern fall draw. He'll be to you a restorer of your life. Imagine a man up that old, having no heir, no son, no wife, nothing, and all of a sudden, in an old age when he'd already given up any hopes of ever having an heir, a wife, or children, now he's going to be to you a restorer of your life, a nourisher of your old age. Your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons. Naomi took the child, laid it in her bosom, and became nurse to it. The women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there's a son born to Naomi. They called his name Obed. Now, that showed they didn't have to name it after the dead father whose name he was carrying on. That was a figure of speech of maintaining an inheritance in the nation or the land and not carrying on a name technically. They called his name Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then he gives the generations of Pharaoh. Of course, he skips over some. He just gives 10 here. Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. So it stops at David, showing it was written before that time, and of course, it was written by Samuel. One comment about the shoes. Kyle writes, the custom itself, which existed among the Indians and the ancient Germans, arose from the fact that fixed property was taken possession of by treading upon the soil. And hence taking off the shoe and handing it to another was the symbol of the transfer of a possession or right of ownership. You know, it strikes me when you're going through something like that, that Mr. Armstrong's always said it's harder to unlearn than it is to learn. You know, if you could spend your whole time just seeing what all you could learn from the Book of Ruth, it wouldn't take so long to cover it. But when you have to show what all people have gotten out of it, it doesn't say, it takes a lot more time to unlearn than it does just to learn. Okay, Psalm 61. Psalm 61, hear my cry, O God, attend unto my prayer. From the end of the earth I'll cry to you when my heart is overwhelmed. Lead me to the rock higher than I, for you've been a shelter for me, strong tower from the enemy. I've got conscientious objector on verse 3 there, showing that it's God being our shield and shelter and not military might. I will abide in your tabernacle forever. I'll trust in the covert of your wing. Selah. First verse 4, you can use as a holy day verse. I'll abide in your tabernacle. I think the first verses altogether talk about a place of safety, too. From the end of the earth, we can cry to God when our heart's overwhelmed. God has led us to the rock that's higher than we are. He's been a shelter, and we're abiding in his temporary shelter, temporary dwelling. Tabernacle, trusting in the covert of his wing. For you, O God, you heard my vows. You've given me the heritage of those that fear your name. Fear of God is another great subject through the Bible. There's a heritage people who fear God are going to receive, and David's saying God is going to give him that same heritage. You'll prolong the king's life and his years as many generations. Probably a prophecy about David, how God is going to raise David back up and prolong David's life and make his years last over many generations. But they didn't. He just reigned 40 years. He'll abide before God forever.